up in store. Buy online, have delivered to your house. Same day, next day, second day.
Charlie O'Shea is a senior retail analyst with Moody's. Consumers like this, especially curbside pickup, where you drive up and someone from the store drops your stuff in your trunk and then you drive off. Andrew Lipsman is a retail analyst with eMarketer.
It fits into their schedule, driving home from work. They save on shipping costs. Another key driver is really concerns around package theft.
He says curbside pickup accounted for 80% of the surge in digital sales. Target was able to save money on shipping, too. It uses its own stores as distribution centers for local delivery. Target's CEO told CNBC that, and curbside pickup cut costs by 90%. Greg Portell is with A.T. Kearney.
They are bringing together digital and physical in ways that many other retailers haven't been able to successfully do.
The stuff that Target stores carry is also often tailored to local markets, says Moody's Charlie O'Shea.
They're able to put just laser in on the local market and what those folks are going to buy, and they've set the back rooms up so that they're able to do that.
Now, of course, the big driver behind all these efforts to make it easier for consumers to buy things is that consumers are willing to buy things. As long as that holds up, so will Target's fortunes. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Speaking of which, consumers and the health of this economy, over at the Federal Reserve, everybody is in the loop about interest rates. The minutes of the Fed's most recent meeting were announced today. And unless the data gets worse, ain't no more interest rates coming for a while, gang. On Wall Street this Wednesday, things took a turn lower on speculation a trade deal with China might not get done this year. Of course, that could all change tomorrow. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Amazon is, well, it's everything, right? It's big. It's connected. Think of their cloud services business. It's a go-to for tens of millions of consumers in this economy. And it's also, it turns out, something of a CEO factory for American startups. Dana Mattioli wrote about this for the Wall Street Journal today. Dana, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
What has put Amazon in the company of, like, you know, companies like GE, which used to breed, you know, CEOs of other companies like it was going out of style?
Yeah, so Amazon has sort of stolen that CEO factory title from General Electric. And people who have gone through Amazon's program have come out and founded or ran giant companies. We're talking like Hulu, WeWork's interim CEOs from Amazon, Tableau Software, Zulily, the list goes on.
Do you think this is real? I mean, would these people have gotten, you know, these jobs or had their success even if they were at, you know, the Acme widget company?
That's a great question. Is it the chicken or the egg?
Right.
Amazon hiring great people that would have been CEOs independently of that, or are they grooming them? And I think it's probably a mix of both. They have a very rigorous and different sort of hiring process than other places that is meant to weed out, you know, weaker candidates. That could be part of it. But these are probably, there's a level of self-selection here. If you're applying to a job at Amazon, you probably have a lot of these skills that are embodied there.
Let us detour here for a moment to Jeff Bezos, who long ago put into place these leadership principles. I think there are 14 of them that, as you say in this article, a lot of these executives have taken with them.
That's right. So there's 14 well-defined leadership principles at Amazon. And the way this story sort of came about is when I was speaking to people who had since left Amazon, even years ago, they would talk about randomly bringing up these leadership principles in conversation at their new companies, even though that was not the leadership principle there, even with their kids. These are so ingrained in executives at Amazon that it becomes part of their vernacular outside of the office.
The big one, of course, is every day is day one in Amazon, right? Every day, we got to prove ourselves every day. We're a startup. Go, go, go.
Yeah, that's a very common saying from Jeff Bezos. It's not one of the leadership principles, but it's something that comes up in every shareholder letter and all hands meetings.
So it's a leadership principle with an asterisk or something. All right. So, but look, there's another part of this, right? And it's that Amazon is known as a really hard place to work. I have an acquaintance who was there and is no longer. Part of that is you know, certainly personal choice. But part of it also is that it can be tough in Amazon culture-wise.
That's correct. A lot of the CEOs I spoke to from this story said that they learned a lot at Amazon and it did set them up to become leaders elsewhere. And they've sort of cherry-picked what they want to bring with them in their new capacity. So they're bringing along things like strong leadership principles and ways of doing business from Amazon. But some of them are saying, you know, they're striving for a more empathetic culture than they might have found there.
Dana Mattioli covers Amazon for the Wall Street Journal. Dana, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
What with Thanksgiving being next week, this seems as good a time as any to talk about the business of food, specifically America's Test Kitchen, the multi-decades-old food media enterprise that includes America's Test Kitchen, the PBS show, Cook's Illustrated Magazine, Cook's Country, the PBS show and magazine, a podcast, a ton of cookbooks, a subscription-based website, online cooking classes, a cooking club for kids. You get the idea. The guy running all of that is America's Test Kitchen CEO David Nussbaum. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kai.
Chairman of the board and CEO of America's Test Kitchen, you may be. We should say at the outset, you're not really a cook, though, right?
I am very much of an amateur, and I became that when I joined the company.
In the company of professionals. So what do you do? How do you, as the guy running the enterprise, maintain the voice for which America's Test Kitchen is so well known?
Well, you know, my job really is to build a strategy that helps us move to more platforms, to reach more people, to reach new geographies, to help our people identify trends, and, you know, at the end of the day, you know, make the business bigger and more profitable.
What are your new platforms? I mean, probably people know you best for the television show, the magazine, of course, Cook's Illustrated, which, full disclosure, we were once upon a time subscribers to in my house.
Thank you.
Where else are you going?
A lot of places, actually. First of all, we have a digital website that is subscription only, and it's one of the largest, I think, in the country outside of kind of the big newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
We have over 420,000 subscribers to that website. It's gated, so unlike most websites, you cannot get any information free.
Well, so hang on right there for a minute, because I can go online and get a recipe for pretty much everything and not have to pay anybody a dime.
That's right. But what you will not get is the America's Test Kitchen touch. And what that is that we test every recipe between 40 and 60 times. We spend an average of $10,000 on every recipe.
Are you kidding me? $10,000? No,
$10,000 per recipe, and sometimes a little bit more, sometimes a little bit less, but that's the average. So when you use our recipe, and if you follow it carefully, the food will be perfect and the presentation will be magnificent, and no one else can make that claim.
Okay. All of which, yes, fine, and I appreciate the rigor that you bring, but isn't cooking a little bit of the, hey, let's try some of this and see what happens, as opposed to you must put 14 grams of flour and then 2 grams of sugar or whatever it is?
Well, it depends. Do you want a meal that's really, 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 really good and has been tested by pros, or do you want to kind of take a shot and hope that it comes out well?
I can't go too much farther in this interview without acknowledging the 800-pound bow-tied gorilla in the room, Chris Kimball, who we have recently had on this program. And I don't want to get into the back and forth that y'all have had, but I do want to point out that the icon of this company departed, and it does not seem to have hurt the business model at all. You guys are doing all right.
Well, the ratings of the two TV shows have grown. The revenue of the business has grown. The profits have grown. We've moved into new markets like podcasts. So we wish him well, but the company rocks on. You know, the strength of the TV shows has always been really the ensemble. It's not one person.
Mm-hmm.
And so he did leave, but we have, you know, really superstars like Bridget and Julia and Jack and Adam. So we're doing quite fine ourselves.
Why did you take this job?
That's a really good question. You know, my history is that I've run companies backed by private equity.
Yeah.
And what that means is that I've been hired to come into a company. Generally, it's a company that is highly levered, and my job was to build the company and sell it. That's a really hard job.
Mm.
You know, you're constantly for sale. Your staff knows that. And I decided back in 2015 when I sold my last company that I don't want to do that anymore. You know, I want to find a place that could be a home that's privately held, that we invest in the business and don't think about the next quarter. And I looked around, and America's Test Kitchen was the very best of them.
I started with a cooking question. I will end with a cooking question, and it goes like this. How much of what you do at America's Test Kitchen is responding to how we're cooking now versus leading us, if you will, guiding us to cook in a certain way?
Well, it's really a combination, because one of the other, you know, special attributes of our recipes that I should have mentioned earlier is that we have a group of about 35,000 people who have volunteered to test our recipes. So the process of how our recipes evolve is partially our chefs and our cooks and our editors, and partially the input of our fans and people who are actually in their home kitchens cooking.
David Nussbaum is the chairman and the CEO, definitely not the head chef at America's Test Kitchen. David, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We've got more of my conversation with David Nussbaum for subscribers of our Corner Office podcast, which is, by the by, totally free, available wherever fine podcasts are distributed. Coming up.
I've done some paintings in Fiji and Hawaii.
Not a bad side hustle, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 112 today, 0.4%, 27,821. The NASDAQ down 43 points, about 0.5%, 85.26. The S&P 500 slumped 11 points, 0.3%, 31.08. We talked about Target's strong quarterly report, zipped up 14%, did Target shares. But the retail apparel news is kind of mixed. Urban Outfitters, that also owns the Anthropologie brand, dressed down more than 15% today after its report missed the mark. In the home improvement retail space, since we were talking about Home Depot a little bit, Lowe's rose 3.9% today. Home Depot, though, down another 2.1% on the day today. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 1.74%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cabot Creamery, a farmer-owned co-op celebrating 100 years of making dairy products from fresh ingredients. Farm families working together to produce naturally aged cheddar cheese. More information at cabotcheese.coop. And by Personal Capital, helping over 2 million people plan for retirement with their online financial tools. You can download the Personal Capital app to link and see all your accounts in one place. PersonalCapital.com. And by Atlassian. Whether it's keeping thousands of people on the same page or managing projects from start to finish, Atlassian works to unleash the potential of all types of teams with collaboration software. More at Atlassian.com.
Today marks another day of public hearings in the House impeachment inquiry. One of the president's staunchest defenders, Republican Congressman Jim Jordan.
But I think he really is seen not as much a policy person as a very articulate and passionate spokesperson.
An in-depth profile of Jim Jordan this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered coming our way in just about 15 minutes today at 4:30 here on KCBX. Local support is provided by General Store Paso Robles, specializing in local goods, gift packs, artisan foods, and provisions for the pantry and home. Open daily downtown on the park, celebrating 6 years on the Central Coast on Instagram, Facebook, or at generalstorepr.com. Support is also provided by UCSB Arts and Lectures, presenting an American Moonshot, John F. Kennedy and the Great Space Race, featuring historian and best-selling author Douglas Brinkley, December 5th at Campbell Hall. Tickets at artsandlectures.ucsb.edu. This is KCBX Public Radio. You're listening to Marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A story now about beer. Sadly, not really about actual beer, but a beer company, more like. One of the big names in craft brewing, New Belgium, out of Colorado, maker, among others, of Fat Tire Ale, is selling to a subsidiary of the Japanese beer maker Kirin, thus bringing to an end one of the better-known examples of an employee-owned company. New Belgium switched to all-employee ownership in 2012 through something called an employee stock ownership plan. Only about 6,000 or so companies in this economy are set up that way. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has the primer.
The number of employee-owned companies like New Belgium has dipped slightly over the last decade or so, but there are actually more workers in the ones that are left, according to Lauren Rogers with the National Center for Employee Ownership.
Employee-owned companies tend to be just more productive, so they grow faster, they increase their own employment faster than the average business.
Research shows there's less turnover, too.
I've been with the company for 33 years.
Sandra Reed is an executive at the Davy Tree Expert Company, which specializes in yard care and is one of the largest employee-owned companies in the country with about 11,000 employees.
Employee ownership is definitely one of the reasons that keeps me with the Davy organization. We work for ourselves and we work for each other.
While entirely employee-owned companies like Davy or New Belgium are rare, almost half of private sector companies give workers some kind of stake in a business through stock options or profit sharing, says Joseph Blasi, a professor at Rutgers University. He says these kinds of plans can help reduce growing income inequality.
Having a chance to own some shares in your company or share in the profits, that's a way for financial inclusion and fairness.
Blasi says all the benefits to productivity and retention can sometimes make these companies a victim of their own success. Employees want to cash out when business is good, and if they sell, that's one less company owned by its workers. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
There are, for those who are counting, 14 games in the National Football League, something like 50 NCAA games, and who knows how many high school and youth games this coming weekend and in the coming week. And nearly half of the people watching those games will be women. On the sidelines, though, and in the league and team offices, not quite so many, by which I mean not even close to as many women. Sam Rappaport is trying to change that. She is the Senior Director of Diversity and Inclusion at the National Football League. Sam, thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me.
This is going to sound like a kind of a fundamental question, but why does the NFL want more women in football? What's the business case?
The business case really is to ensure that we're considering the entire talent pool when we are staffing our football operations positions and our business operations positions. And so previously, you know, women felt disenfranchised from some of these positions, and we're trying to build a bridge and connect them to people that could put them in a position to hire them.
Football is not without its challenges now, most specifically the idea of physical wellness of these players. How do you justify getting more people in to support and continue that system?
Yeah, I mean, it's the most popular sport in the country. There's no reason why the entire population shouldn't get involved if they so desire. And so, you know, me personally growing up, I was obsessed with football. I never missed a game. I always knew I wanted to work in the NFL, and so I want to make sure that if there are other young girls or people of color, people who are new to this country that have an interest in football, that they believe it's for them as well.
With all respect, Sam, you didn't answer the question, right? Because it's a tough time for football.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, as far as it being a tough time for football, I think that people love the game. They still want to be involved in it. They still watch it. You know, we have thousands of women who have contacted us for our programs that want to get involved, and so we want to make sure that they can be.
What's your marker for success? Do you want 50% female head coaches? Is that where you're going?
No, our overall mission is to normalize women in football. Yeah. So what we want is for us to stop talking about the fact that that coach is female or that scout is a female, and we just want it to normalize. And so, you know, we're not putting any markers on the first female this or that. We really want to flood the pipeline with as many girls and women who want to work in football and creating representation for young girls coming up.
How did you get yourself to the NFL? I mean, we were talking before we turned the microphones on. You're Canadian. You've played some flag football up there and some other kinds of stuff. How did you get to where you are now?
Yeah, I was a girl growing up that was obsessed with the sport, played it at a young age in Canada. Girls flag and touch football is ubiquitous. It was an easy entry into the sport. And same goes for Mexico, but in the United States, that wasn't the case. And, you know, my father asked me at one point in high school what I wanted to do. And I mentioned the only thing I want to do is work in football. And so when I was in college, I applied for an internship at the NFL. And I knew I had to stand out. I had no connections. I didn't know anyone that worked in the industry. And I sent a picture of me in my full tackle football uniform. I was a quarterback, and I sent a football with my resume, and on the football I wrote, what other quarterback could accurately deliver a pass 386 miles, which was the distance between Montreal, where I went to school, and New York. And so, you know, it stood out. It was gimmicky, but, you know, I knew that I had to do something to show how badly I wanted it, and it worked, and I got my first internship in 2003.
Yeah, good for you. That's a great lesson. But look, let me ask you sort of a corollary question, right? For football players, the overwhelming majority of whom are male as they proceed through the high school and college and professional ranks, they get into the youth pipeline early, right? They start playing, they move up, they get bigger, stronger, faster. Is it attractive to a teenage girl to be the team manager for the high school football team and move up that way? How do you sell that?
Yeah, Kai, you just identified the number one barrier that women have to entry into football, which is boys grow up in it and girls don't.
Right, right.
And so what we're trying to do is create opportunities, you know, at the youth and high school level where they can learn the skill set that they need to develop on. And we've seen a couple instances of high schools that have brought on equal number of women to men or have started to bring on more women. So that trend is something that we're proud of.
Sam Rappaport, she's the Senior Director of Diversity and Inclusion at the National Football League. Sam, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
Ski resorts are going to start opening in the next couple of weeks, and if you're a skier, or maybe probably even if you're not, there's a good chance you've used or at least seen a trail map. Which run goes where, how hard they are, and which lift you need to take to get to where you need to go. They're often pretty detailed, these maps, sometimes quite artistic, and they don't paint themselves, you know. My Economy is our series about people out there making a go of it.
I'm James Niehues. I'm from Parker, Colorado, and I paint ski maps. I was a freelance graphic designer in Denver and was looking for jobs and decided to check in on Bill Brown, the previous trail map illustrator, and walked in looking for maybe some extra work and walked out with a career. I've painted around 200 different ski resorts around the world, a total of probably near 400 individual paintings. You know, sometimes I'll do an inset for a couple of $1,000s, and the large ski area today around 15,000 to produce that. They then have the full rights to use that image for as long as they want for any purpose they want. In fact, the very first trail map that I ever produced, which was Boreal, California, is still in use, and that's 30 years later. The ski industry is a pretty small industry to support more than a few artists to do the trail maps. You don't always have a steady flow of ski maps to paint. Some years, 10 of them will decide to have a new trail map, and then I'm very busy. And other years, it may be down to two or three, and I'm looking for other avenues of income. So because of that, I've done quite a few summer versions. I've done some paintings in Fiji and Hawaii and national parks. There are very lean years in this business, and I think that's a lot of the reason why, I don't have a lot of competition is because it is such a small market. Well, right now I'm trying to be semi-retired, but I find that I'm busier than ever. I've got a pretty full slate this year. I have a protege that is coming along, so he's doing a few now and then. But to be frank with you, I get a good project in, and I just don't pass it on to him. I have to take it myself.
James Niehues there. His book, The Man Behind the Maps, is out now. Can't do this series without your help. I know I say this all the time, but it's true. There is a spot at marketplace.org where you can send us stories of your economy. This final note on the way out today from the What Could Possibly Go Wrong department. Uber, reports the Washington Post, is going to start recording its rides. Audio only, and so far just a pilot program in Latin America. Testing in the United States at a date still TBD. You get the safety benefits, obviously, but still.
Marketplace is supported by Forex.com, helping traders find opportunity in currency trading for over 18 years. Forex.com, it's your world, trade it. Forex trading involves significant risk of loss. And by Avalara, businesses of all sizes choose Avalara to simplify their sales tax compliance with real-time rates and automatic filing. Learn more at Avalara.com. Avalara, tax compliance done right. And by Edison Research, dedicated to quality consumer research and public opinion polling for corporations and organizations worldwide. Learn more at edisonresearch.com/marketplace.
Oh, look, time's up. Dow Industrials down 112 today, 0.4%. The NASDAQ off 43 points, that's about 0.5%. The S&P 500 tumbled 11 points, 0.3%. No, 0.3% is not really a tumble. I get that. Our media production team includes Sarah Bruguer, Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, J.C. Bold, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Support for KCBX is provided by Sunset Honda in San Luis Obispo, where you can experience simple, straightforward car buying with their transparent lease, and they donate a percentage of each sale to a local nonprofit. Learn more at sunsethonda.com. This is KCBX. It's 4:29.
The Trump administration's clampdown at the southern border has migrants looking for a new route into the U.S.
They're feeling a lot more pressure than they ever had down south, and they found loopholes to exploit via Canada.
How are tensions at the northern border changing the character of a once neighborly frontier?
I feel it's very intimidating just to have the barrier there. It's like a wall.
Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
You can hear Morning Edition tomorrow morning starting at 3 a.m. till 9 here on KCBX. Local support is provided by Ranch Wi-Fi, providing high-speed internet access for rural homes and businesses in northern Santa Barbara, San Luis Obispo, and southern Monterey counties. Learn more at ranchwifi.com or at 805-995-4181. This is KCBX. It's 4:30. Time for All Things Considered.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Next, a man who spent 36 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit is free.
You know, he's sent to Angola prison, basically told he's going to die there. Life sentence, no possibility of parole.
Now, Archie Williams is performing at a talent competition at the Apollo Theater in New York.
First, the newscast.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. A key witness for Democrats in the impeachment probe on Capitol Hill testified today that there was a quid pro quo linking military aid to President Trump's demands that Ukraine announce an investigation into Joe Biden and into a debunked theory that Ukraine interfered in the 2016 presidential election. Ambassador Gordon Sondland testified that everyone was in the loop regarding Trump's demands. Sondland told the House Intelligence Committee those demands were relayed to him by the president's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani. Here's NPR's Michelle Kellerman.
Now, the one thing that Sondland said he doesn't remember saying that he only believes in the investigations into the Bidens, but that was kind of the subtext that we now know.
NPR's Michelle Kellerman. The hearings have resumed with more witness testimony. A federal grand jury has indicted former Baltimore Mayor Catherine Pugh of wire fraud, tax evasion, and conspiracy to defraud the United States. Emily Sullivan of member station WYPR reports Pugh could face up to 175 years in prison.
The 11-count indictment focuses on Healthy Holly LLC, a company that Catherine Pugh used to distribute her children's books. As a state senator, the Democrats struck up deals with companies seeking to do business with Maryland. In some cases, she allegedly resold the same books to different buyers. U.S. Attorney Robert Herr says she used the proceeds to build personal wealth, advance her political career, and legally fund her mayoral campaign.
Fraud and corruption of the sort we are addressing today undermine the public's faith in public officials. This is a tragedy and the last thing that our city needs.
Pugh is due to appear in court Thursday, where she may enter a plea. For NPR News, I'm Emily Sullivan in Baltimore.
Stocks finished lower on Wall Street. The Dow lost 112 points. This is NPR News.
Yeah, it's Public Radio KCBX at 432. I'm Hank Hadley, and here's Tyler Pratt today, sitting in for Greta Mart.
Thank you, Hank, and good afternoon. A bill to protect a stretch of the California coast made it past another hurdle in the United States House of Representatives this week. The Central Coast Heritage Protection Act passed through the House Natural Resources Committee.
We are so excited about this bill. It will permanently protect about 250,000 acres of wilderness, some of the most unique public lands and rivers in California, from oil development, mining, logging, and other threats. And it's all right here in the Los Padres National Forest and Carrizo Plain National Monument.
That's Rebecca August with the Los Padres Forest Watch. The nonprofit works to protect public lands and worked with Central Coast Congressman Salud Carbajal and California Senator Kamala Harris, who sponsored the legislation.
And this is the first time in the bill's 10-year history, we've been working on it for that long, that it's advanced to a floor vote in Congress.
As it's currently written, the act will also designate a 400-mile-long trail from Los Angeles County to Monterey County to be called the Condor National Recreation Trail. The bill still has a ways to go before it becomes law. It will require a signature from President Trump, who has previously reversed U.S. environmental protections he says impede economic growth. The city of San Luis Obispo is looking for volunteers to serve on several advisory bodies. The groups review city programs, projects, and community issues, and advise staff and the city council on policies. Currently, there are openings on the county's Commission on Aging, Parks and Recreation Committee, Tourism Business Improvement District Board, Housing Authority, and 10 other bodies. Those interested can apply online on the city's website. For most boards, the qualifications are primarily be a resident and be registered to vote within the city of San Luis Obispo. Our coverage of California and the Central Coast will continue in about half an hour. I'm Tyler Pratt, KCBX News.
Local support for KCBX is provided by Ranch Wi-Fi, providing high-speed internet access for rural homes and businesses in northern Santa Barbara, San Luis Obispo, and southern Monterey counties. Learn more at ranchwifi.com or at 805-995-4181. This is KCBX. It's now 435.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Zoom. Zoom offers cloud video conferencing, online meetings, and a video conference room solution in one platform, featuring digital video and audio with screen sharing, account registration, and more at zoom.us. From Indeed, with its skills tests, built for employers who want to see a deeper sense of the person behind the resume. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Throughout the impeachment inquiry, veteran diplomats have raised concerns about a so-called irregular back channel that was sending a message to the new president of Ukraine. And that message, if you want U.S. support, announce investigations into President Trump's political rivals. Today's key witness said all of that happened out in the open.
I'm not sure how someone could characterize something as an irregular channel when you're talking to the President of the United States, the Secretary of State, the National Security Advisor, the Chief of Staff of the White House, the Secretary of Energy. I don't know how that's irregular.
That's U.S. Ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland. Now, to help us make sense of the U.S. approach to Ukraine, we've asked a former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine to join us, Stephen Pfeiffer. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
How much did what you, how much of what you heard today deviate from the norm?
Well, the channel, there was this, obviously, whether you want to call it an irregular channel, However you term it, it was a channel that was not pursuing U.S. government interests. What Ambassador Yovanovitch was doing in Ukraine before her early removal, and then Ambassador Taylor was designed to advance U.S. interests. And on the side, whether you call it an irregular channel or whatever, you've got Mr. Giuliani, Ambassador Sondland, working on an effort that's designed to promote the president's personal political interests.
Sounds like you weren't buying Sondland's saying that, look, it's not irregular. Everybody understood what was going on.
Well, I think one of the things that we learned today was, at least at the top, it sounds like the chief of staff at the White House, the secretary of state, the vice president were aware. But, you know, people who are working and managing U.S.-Ukraine relations on a day-to-day basis, it appears we're not involved. Deputy Assistant Secretary Ken at the State Department, for example, or Dr. Fiona Hill and Colonel Vindman at the National Security Council. They only became aware rather late in the game about this.
Now, Sondland also insisted that there was a clear quid pro quo, that Ukraine's President Zelensky had to call for investigations if Zelensky wanted to get that meeting with the president or military aid. But Zelensky has always said there was no pressure, no blackmail from the U.S. How do you understand those remarks based on your experience in Ukraine?
Well, I'm not surprised. I mean, there is no advantage to President Zelensky or to Ukraine for him to come out now and directly contradict the president of the United States. What Ukraine has to do, and I think they're doing a fairly good job of it the last couple months, is walk this fine line between, on the one hand, trying not to antagonize the president, but also, and I was in Ukraine about 2.5 weeks ago, as far as I could see, there are no serious investigations. They also don't want to have Ukraine inserted into our domestic politics in a way that would disrupt a huge asset that Ukraine has had going back to 1991, which is that is bipartisan support from Republicans and Democrats alike in Congress.
But now so Ukraine is in the headlines all the time. I mean, you were in Kyiv. How are people reacting to the impeachment inquiry in the U.S.?
They're nervous. I mean, Russia has inflicted a conflict on Ukraine now for more than 5 years. More than 13,000 people have been killed. And while Ukrainians want to be fully integrated in Europe, they look at the United States and say the United States is the geopolitical balance to Russia. And anything that sort of threatens to cause tension or problems in that relationship between Washington and Kyiv is going to make Ukraine nervous, you know, particularly now at a crucial time when they have a fairly new president. And in just a couple of weeks, he's going to sit down for his first meeting with Vladimir Putin and try to see if he can end the war in eastern Ukraine.
He's doing that as the U.S. has no envoy, right, since Ambassador Kurt Volker stepped down. Does that make sense for us?
It depends on how we want to pursue the diplomacy. Remember, Ambassador Volker first came on board and his duty was primary function was to deal with the Russians in a way to support the German and French-led effort to mediate a peace. My understanding is for the last year and a half or so, the Russians haven't been prepared to engage with Ambassador Volker. So that is really no longer relevant. But mm-hmm. It may need, if we wanted to be more actively engaged, we may need to have some more diplomatic horsepower to help with Ukraine.
That's former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Stephen Pfeiffer. He's now a senior fellow at Brookings. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
The stock market slumped today after a report that a mini trade deal between the U.S. and China may not be finalized anytime soon. The Dow Jones Industrial Average tumbled more than 250 points after Reuters reported that negotiations over a Phase 1 trade deal could drag into next year. Markets paired their losses later in the day, and a White House spokesman insists progress towards a deal is being made. But with trade tensions weighing on the U.S. economy, President Trump is once again trying to blame the Federal Reserve, NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
President Trump often treats the stock market as a scoreboard of his personal performance, especially when stocks are up. Speaking to a business audience in New York last week, Trump boasted the Dow has jumped more than 50% since the 2016 election, and the Nasdaq's gains are even bigger.
And if we had a Federal Reserve that worked with us, you could have added another 25% to each one of those numbers. I guarantee you that.
Trump has complained repeatedly that the Fed was too quick to raise interest rates last year and too slow to cut them this year. While the central bank has cut rates 3 times since July, Trump notes other countries have done more to encourage borrowing, in some cases even pushing interest rates below zero.
Give me some of that. Give me some of that money. I want some of that money. Our Federal Reserve doesn't let us do it.
Trump renewed that argument this week when he summoned Fed Chairman Jerome Powell to the White House for a meeting. where the president says he protested the level of interest rates. Trump described the meeting with Powell as cordial, but Kathy Bosjancic of Oxford Economics warns the president's tone could change quickly.
In some sense, it looks like he's setting the Federal Reserve up as the fall guy if the economy does go south.
One of the biggest weights on the economy has been the president's own trade policy, which Bosjancic says has paralyzed business investment while also depressing exports and manufacturing. At its last meeting in October, the Fed's rate-setting committee cut interest rates by a quarter percentage point, but also signaled that's likely to be the last cut for a while, unless the economy worsens. Powell told lawmakers last week the central bank will take its cues from the economy, not the president's browbeating.
Politics plays absolutely no role in our decisions. We use the best data, the best analysis we can muster. We're human, we'll make mistakes, but we won't make mistakes of character or integrity.
Economic growth is already slowing to an annual rate of less than 2% during the summer and fall. Many forecasters expect even slower growth in the final months of this year. While the Fed is likely to leave interest rates where they are in December, Bosjancic says conditions may have changed by the spring of the presidential election year.
Our view would be that as we get into 2020, the data is going to be disappointing and that there would be another rate cut, but it wouldn't come until the March meeting.
Unless a preliminary deal is struck with China by mid-December, the administration is threatening to impose new tariffs on another $160 billion worth of imports, including popular consumer items like cell phones and laptops. At a cabinet meeting this week, Trump told reporters he's feeling no pressure.
If we don't make a deal with China, I'll just raise the tariffs even higher.
Even if the U.S. and China do reach a partial deal, analysts say trade tensions are likely to linger in the new year. That would be a drag on the U.S. economy. But if the slowdown gets bad enough, the Fed may be forced to cut interest rates like the president wants. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. To Thailand, where the Bangkok Fire Department is busy in the summer, not with fires, but snakes. Last year, the department got more than 37,000 snake incursion calls, and this year, it might be more. Michael Sullivan reports.
At the Bang Khen Fire Station near the airport, firefighters sit in the ready room, listening to the radio chatter, waiting for a call. It's still the tail end of the rainy season, and that means
fewer fires, more snakes, and the snakes never stop.
That's the city's chief snake wrangler, 50-year-old Pinyo Puk Pinyo. How many fires? Maybe four or five per day. How many snakes? Sometimes 200 a day, according to Pinyo.
In the Bangkok, just 70% python.
70% are python, and then cobras, pit vipers, and banded crates. The banded crate is the most venomous we find in Bangkok.
Pinyo has been with the fire department for 30 years, the last 15, specializing in snake removal. I ask how many he's caught since the department started answering snake incursion calls in 2003.
About 8,000 in the past 16 years, sometimes as many as 10 or 20 a day.
And yes, they have been known to wiggle their way up through the toilet, even if it's occupied. Pinyo says he's been bitten over 20 times. Each time, he says, he learns something new about not getting bit again and proves it in a demonstration behind the station. There he shows off a 4-foot-long monocled cobra taken from a nearby home the night before. He holds the snake just below its neck and lifts its head right in front of his face. He blames Bangkok's never-ending development for the number of snake incursions that's been increasing every year.
People cross the line when they build in the snake's habitat. We think because we're human, we're always right, and that the snake is the intruder, not us.
In a dark room behind the station's fire trucks, Pinyo's stashed dozens of pythons, cobras, and pit vipers in cages or plastic containers.
We keep these guys here for instruction, to teach others their habits and how to catch them.
The snakes are kept here no more than 2 weeks, he says, then released by the Park Department in a forest far from the city. On the day I visit, Pignot is way below his usual haul. We're in his truck now. The first call turned out to be a bust, but Pignot gets another about a python in the rafters of a house 10 minutes away. He's been here many times because the woman who lives here keeps chickens, and the chicken feed attracts mice and rats. Pignot says he once caught a python here more than 15 feet long. Today's intruder is just a baby. That's still big enough to scare 50-year-old Wiyada Wachira Pakborn.
Very much. They look very scary to me, and I'm afraid it's going to bite me. So I'm very happy when Pignot comes.
Pignot laughs and tucks the baby python into a bag. He predicts he'll be back here within a week.
With accidents or fires, it's very sad when you see people lose people they love or their property. But when I catch a snake, I'm happy.
Happy, he says, because he can make people who are desperate or insecure feel safe in their own homes. For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan in Bangkok.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Local support for KCBX this afternoon is provided by MM Organics in Paso Robles, producing organic walnuts and an organic port-style dessert wine for the holidays. Their produce is in local organic stores and at their farm stand off Adelaide Road. Details at mmorganics.com. It's listener-supported public radio, KCBX. I'm Hank Hadley with your KCBX weather forecast. It's 61 in King City, 56 at Atascadero. Here at KCBX in San Luis Obispo, it's also 56 degrees. Look for partly cloudy skies with overnight lows in the low 40s. Tomorrow, look for continued cloudy skies and cooler than normal temperatures. In the Inland Valleys, Paso Robles will have a high of 64, Soledad 69, and Solvang 63. In the coastal valleys tomorrow, San Luis Obispo has a forecast of 61, Grover Beach 60 degrees, and along the coast, Pismo Beach's forecast is 61, Morro Bay 63, and Santa Barbara 65 degrees. You're listening to Public Radio KCBX as we check out the KCBX community calendar. The jazz ensembles at Cal Poly are under new leadership, and the music department welcomes Arthur White as the new director of jazz studies. You can enjoy the Cal Poly Fall Jazz Concert on Friday night at the Spanos Theater on the Cal Poly campus. For more information about this and other events, check out the KCBX community calendar on our website, kcbx.org. You're listening to NPR's All Things Considered. It's now 10 minutes before 5 o'clock.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The public phase of the House impeachment inquiry has pushed Republican Jim Jordan to center stage.
You use clear language, clear understanding, and commitment, and those two things didn't happen, so you had to be wrong.
The Ohio congressman's loyalty to the president and his combative staccato interrogation style are a big part of why Republicans added him to the committee leading up to the inquiry. Nick Evans of member station WOSU visited Jordan's district to hear what his constituents make of the GOP's high-profile inquisitor.
Urbana is an old railroad town in western Ohio, and it's where Jim Jordan was raised. There's a bustling little restaurant downtown called Cafe Paradiso, where Rob Pollack is sitting on a stool. He heads this county's Republican Party and says Jordan's brash style is what his voters want to see.
It's not the same Washington, D.C. that it used to be. So I think it is helpful to our district that our congressman is sharp enough to recognize that what worked in the past isn't going to work in the future.
Jordan's hometown is part of a gerrymandered district sprawling from far western Ohio to the outskirts of Cleveland, nearly 150 miles northeast. It's solidly Republican, offering Jim Jordan some latitude in staking out political positions and defending the president.
The American people see through all this. They understand the facts support the president. They understand this process is unfair. And they see through the whole darn sham.
He's become a fixture in the impeachment hearings, jaw set, glaring over the top of his glasses to grill witnesses. That take-no-prisoner style was on full display last week as he interrogated Ambassador Bill Taylor.
You didn't listen on President Trump's call and President Zelensky's call?
I did not.
You've never talked with Chief of Staff Mulvaney?
I never did.
You never met the president?
That's correct.
You had three meetings again with Zelensky and it didn't come up.
And two of those they had never heard about as far as I know.
Although Jordan is often associated with the Tea Party, he was elected to Congress a few years earlier. He helped establish the Freedom Caucus, which was able to turn a handful of strident conservative voices into a potent political check on GOP leadership in the House. But Ohio State political scientist Paul Beck notes the congressman's legislative accomplishments are limited. He says in Congress there are workhorses and show horses.
And he has been more a show horse. He indeed has authored legislation, but I think he really is seen not as much a policy person as a very articulate and passionate spokesperson for the most conservative part of the Republican Party.
As an outspoken conservative, Jordan does have his detractors here. Back at the cafe, William Hoke finds his embrace of President Trump and his aggressive style off-putting.
I really don't agree with a lot of the stuff these Republicans are doing. I am not appreciative of the fact that he seems to be one of the top people defending this guy.
Outside of politics, Jordan's defining experience is probably wrestling. He was a state champion all 4 years in high school and a national champ twice in college. Those around him often bring it up to explain his combative style. Mike Pacillo was a national wrestling champ at Ohio State a few years after Jordan served there as an assistant coach. And Pacillo used to attend camps run by the Jordan family. He doesn't agree with Jordan's politics.
That being said, as a person, like, there are a handful of good people that I think in Washington. And whether I agree or disagree with him, I do think he is probably on the top of the list.
But Jordan's wrestling history comes with baggage. Hundreds of athletes and students now report they were molested by a team doctor during Jordan's tenure. Jordan has repeatedly insisted he knew nothing about that. The congressman has never faced a strong challenger, and many here say as long as he's defending the president, he'll likely remain popular. For NPR News, I'm Nick Evans in Columbus.
And now the story of a second chance. Archie Williams spent 36 years in prison for a crime he did not commit. Tonight, he's performing at New York City's Apollo Theater in the amateur night competition. NPR's Rose Friedman reports.
Archie Williams likes his odds.
I'm a win. That's how I feel. I'm a win.
He's made it through two rounds, and he's pretty psyched.
I always dreamed of going to the amateur night at Apollo, and my dream has come true.
I met Archie Williams in his lawyer's office at the Innocence Project in New York. He was goofing around in the hallway, not unlike a kid letting off some steam.
You went into prison when you were 22?
Two.
Do you feel like you're picking up where you left off? Do you feel like 22?
I sure do. And I still do the things that I did when I was 22 right now.
Mainly that's singing. Williams says he grew up in a talented family in Baton Rouge, but his musical career was cut short by his arrest for a 1982 rape and attempted murder. His lawyer, Vanessa Potkin, picks up the story.
He was just, you know, walking down the street one day when the police snatched him up and ended up putting his photograph in a photo array that was viewed by a woman who had been attacked in her home.
The woman didn't identify Williams at first, but she was shown his photo two more times. Eventually, she told police it was him, and he was convicted.
You know, he's sent to Angola prison, basically told he's going to die there. You know, life sentence, no possibility of parole.
He endured prison life, but there was one small saving grace. He was able to form a band.
That's the first place I was ever able to sing gospel in, and it was Angola, so I was like a new birth there.
Also during that time, Williams reached out to the Innocence Project. He was 12 years into his sentence.
We recognized that forensic science could help prove him innocent. The state fought tooth and nail.
Potkin says the state of Louisiana wouldn't give them access to evidence, including the fingerprints that had been collected at the crime scene.
Really just blocked the way successfully for two decades until a woman named Commissioner Kimball took the bench. She ordered that the fingerprints be searched in the FBI's database. She said, you know, we're going to get to the truth here. And within 8 hours, those prints were matched to a serial assailant and Archie's innocence was proven.
But entering back into society as a 58-year-old isn't easy. The Innocence Project can help Williams pay for an apartment, but they say they're having trouble finding anyone who will rent to him. And he's missed out on a lot.
Well, technology. Today's technology is really my hardest part of what's going on in today's society. I'm learning piano and literacy, computer. So I'm trying to get back into society like I once was because I lost so much.
For his performance at the Apollo, Williams has chosen a Stevie Wonder song. He says to him, the lyrics are spiritual.
I'm pretty sure everyone can relate to I Wish. It all talks about when we was kids, the things we used to do. That's what the song is all about. I wish those days would come back once more. Why did those days have to go? Sneaking out the back door, hang out with those hoodlum friends of mine.
If Archie Williams is successful tonight, he'll be eligible to sing for the $20,000 grand finale prize on November 27th. Rose Friedman, NPR News, New York.
With all the news happening every day, it can be hard to keep up. Check out our podcast, Up First. You get the day's biggest stories in about 10 minutes. It's available every weekday morning wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Home Advisor. Committed to helping homeowners find the right pros for their home projects. Homeowners can read reviews, book appointments, and check cost guides for home projects at homeadvisor.com or on the mobile app. From TIAA, committed to the idea that while most things in life run out, from clean shirts in the morning to a favorite dessert at night, lifetime income in retirement shouldn't. Learn more at TIAA.org/neverrunout. And from Sony Pictures with A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, directed by Marielle Heller and starring Tom Hanks. A journalist learns about empathy and kindness after being assigned a profile of Mr. Rogers. Only in theaters November 22nd.
Local support for KCBX is provided by the Cambria Christmas Market, a festive gathering in the style of Germany's Christmas markets, with entertainment, vendors, lights, food, music, and more through December 23rd. Learn more at CambriaChristmasMarket.com. It's Public Radio KCBX HD1 San Luis Obispo, KNBX HD1 San Arno, and KSBX Santa Barbara. We stream online at kcbx.org.
Again, everyone was in the loop.
A key impeachment witness says everybody from President Trump to the Secretary of State knew about the pressure campaign against Ukraine.
More from Ambassador Gordon Sondland this Wednesday, November 20th, on All Things Considered.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Ambassador Sondland is a Republican Trump appointee. He tied the president directly to demands that Ukraine investigate the Bidens in exchange for military aid.
Was there a quid pro quo? As I testified previously, with regard to the requested White House call and the White House meeting, the answer is yes.
Also this hour, we'll preview tonight's Democratic presidential debate.
And scientists learn more about how the brain depends on syllables to understand speech.
That's the basic Lego block of language.
We'll have those stories and more after these headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. A Pentagon official says Ukraine raised questions about U.S. military assistance as early as July 25th. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports that's earlier than previously known, and the same day as President Trump's call with his Ukrainian counterpart.
Senior Defense Department official Laura Cooper has told House lawmakers that her office received two emails on July 25th that said the Ukrainian embassy was asking questions about U.S. military aid. She says in one of the